Hi, today's August 12th, 2018. This is Mobley's Podcast 264. I'm kind of going to rant a little bit, but John has actual stuff to talk about, so he'll balance out. He'll balance out.
I have interesting observations that intersect my two passions in life of education and technology. So. Okay.
Speaking of passions of a sort, even though neither of us are using an IBM PC or PC descendant at the moment, happy 37th birthday to the IBM PC, which was launched on this day 37 years ago. You hardly look, well, actually, you look pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, when they were released, they weren't the most stylish things
no,
on the planet.
But, no. But 37 years, pretty amazing.
Hardly look a day over 80.
Yeah. next thing, my little rant. So last night, my friend Jay Stone and I recorded Comics News Podcast number 100. And we had fun. You know, we had an interesting topic, which I'm going to discuss briefly in reference to that podcast and suggest you listen to. And I didn't realize it until I went into my audio production to, you know, do the volume leveling and put in the intro and all that stuff, that I had been recording on the MacBook's built-in microphone all night. Because Skype was updated, I don't know when it was up to recently, and decided to reset all my settings. So
it was updated whenever it felt like it,
and yeah.
It didn't tell you that it was going to do it either.
Yeah. And so I didn't realize I'd not been using my nice, what is it, Blue Yeti or whatever the heck I have microphone, which I think is a pretty good microphone. And so, well, the good news is Jay was using some kind of Beats wired Bluetooth headset, and he sounded pretty good, actually.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I'll be posting that along with this podcast sometime today, which is, like I said, August 12th. Anyway, that's my rant. I hate Skype. I keep telling John we should go try Hangouts or something, and I never get around to figuring out how to actually record using that stream instead of Skype, which I've been doing for, you know, almost 10 years now, so it's kind of a no-brainer. Anyway, in reference to Comics News Podcast 100, the reason I'm referencing that here in Mobile Views, in addition to the fact that we hit the 100 milestone, which is pretty neat, we started back in 2011 on that one, Jay and I and our friend Emil Reyes, who's comes and goes. He sometimes comes on. Hasn't been on in a while, but he's always welcome. Last night, we talked about kind of a techie thing, and that is the high cost of streaming superhero videos in the new future. You know, right now, you have Netflix and Amazon Prime and Hulu, and you pretty much got everything. You know, you can watch the Marvel superhero movies. You can watch this DC superhero movies. You can watch a bunch of the TV shows and animated series and so forth. But sometime in the next month or two or three, DC is going to start increasing the fragmentation of this particular genre by introducing its DC Universe, which is going to cost $79 a year if you pay on an annual basis. And sometime next year, Disney is going to further fragment it by creating its own streaming video service, and it'll take away the newer Marvel properties. So I think Ant-Man, though, that was just released this past summer, will be the last of the Marvel movies that appear on Netflix, for example. Mm-hmm. And after that, all the Marvel superhero stuff will only appear in the Disney. Disney owns Marvel, I should note, to people who don't know that. As well as Star Wars. You know, they own the Lucasfilm Star Wars franchise also. So all of that stuff will only appear in the Disney streaming at some point. And I did a little bit of math, and it turns out if you subscribe to the sort of big services, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime, DC Universe, the future Disney streaming service, which does not have a price, but they said they're going to undercut Netflix, so I'm assuming about $120 a year, $130 a year. It's going to cost you over $560 a year to subscribe to all these services, which, you know, it's not unaffordable, but it's not cheap or inexpensive either. It's not something you just say, yeah, sure, I'll pay $500.
$560 a year, also known as a half month of cable.
Well, I don't know about cable's not that expensive, really. I mean, it's about the same cost as cable without the premium channels. Once you have the premium channels,
you can find, though, a cable provider that cuts you a decent deal on just cable TV.
Yeah.
Most of the providers heavily push a package deal where they make a ton of money off of phone service, they make a good amount of money off of TV, and then they kind of, you know, break even a little bit on internet.
Yeah.
But it's not in their best interest to let you get away with just basic cable. So I don't even know if basic cable exists as a thing anymore.
It does, actually. You got to hunt for it.
Yeah.
And they also make it difficult for you to just get internet without cable. So it works the other way, too. If you just want raw internet service, you want to be a cord cutter of sorts, it's tough to do.
Yeah, a friend of mine, so I have Cable One, which is our cable company here.
Never heard of it.
And yeah, exactly. You know, these little regional companies that still exist. But I pay $80 a month for 600 gigs of transfer and pretty fast speeds. You know, I have one of the higher tiers.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that basically because I knew that I had offsite backup that I was doing. I had a couple other things that... Mm-hmm. I needed that level of bandwidth, and I needed that level of speed. The interesting thing is one of my friends recently, with the same company, upgraded to a streaming TV package over the internet.
And right.
You know, these watch basic cable sorts of things. It wasn't YouTube TV, but a similar idea.
Right.
And the cable company proactively stepped up her rate plan to be kind of right below my rate plan.
Huh.
Saying, oh, you're now streaming way too much, and, you know, your internet has to go up. So she cut the cord off of the cable and then promptly started paying more money for internet. So whatever way you cut it, cable companies are going to try to get $80 to $100 out of you a month. And if you can get away with that for just internet, then I guess that plus the streaming services of $560 a year would sort of be affordable. But if you're paying for the streaming services and cable TV and internet, that's just ridiculous. That's going to be over, you know, $1,000-$2,000 a year.
Yeah, I didn't add in the cable or fiber or whatever else you might have in your area. But you're right, it's going to be over $1,000 a year just for the internet plus cable TV.
Yeah.
And you add it to, so you're talking $1,600 a year or something, or more. Almost 2,000 basically, for a video.
Or you could just decide not to watch anything with superheroes.
Or anything, period.
Or
right?
Disney, or Star Wars.
Yeah. Or old TV shows. But, you know, your friend, did they specifically mention streaming, or was it just a data cap thing?
I think basically Cable One said that with her new increased usage, they were going to knock her up to the next one.
Okay.
Cable One has this thing where basically you have to exceed 3 months out of a 12-month period. Before they'll do that, but I think with her, they probably did it proactively because she was probably on a lower tier anyway.
Mm.
With my tier, if I exceed 600 for 3 months out of 12, then they're going to bump me up, but that never happens, so I think I'm adequately priced.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just wondering if they were specifically, they were detecting streaming, and, you know, that was competing with their video services. I wonder if she had to have VPN on, if they would have just said, well, it's a high usage, but... Not streaming.
It's interesting. So. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway,
all right, well,
listen to Comics News 100 for that discussion after I post it.
So today, Todd and I are having our annual, semi-annual, whatever, you know, once a year, once every other year, back-to-school technology discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have children that I send off to school, but I do see a lot of other people's children that get sent off to college classes that I teach. Todd, you, I don't know, did you have to do very much in the way of back to school shopping this fall?
Nope, none at all.
Very good.
None at all.
So today, so the thing that brought me to this idea this week was that, I guess it was Wednesday or Tuesday, a coworker and I usually have lunch together. Her daughter was on campus, and as they're walking up to me to go out to lunch, she goes, oh, feel how heavy her backpack is.
Okay.
So I reach over and I take the backpack and it's, you know, it feels like it's at least 10, 12 pounds.
Yeah.
I said, wow, you've got a lot of books in there. She goes, no, I have one binder in there and a laptop.
Hmm.
And my friend looks at me and she goes, yeah, we need to get her something smaller for school.
What kind of laptop was it or is it?
Well, that's part of the problem. So this person's... former spouse, who's the father of her daughter, went out and bought about a year or two ago a very nice laptop that's a very heavy laptop. It's basically a desktop replacement.
Oh, okay.
And it has the backpack that he bought her also is designed for that, you know, to protect that laptop.
Right. It's heavy duty.
Padding and tons of other things in it. And when she's just using it around the house, it's fine. But lugging it around her school is going to become a major problem. So I said, well, what about an iPad? Because all she really needed was Microsoft Office apps and things like that. And, well, we can't use iPads at school. They don't like us using iPads at school because it's too big of a distraction. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
So this is like in high school, not college or something.
Yes, this is private high school.
Okay.
So they don't really want them using iPads. I said, I'm thinking, well, you know, Microsoft just released the Surface Go. And I think that's actually what they're going to go with because they need something that can run Office apps but isn't an iPad. And Chromebooks, I am still in the camp that Chromebooks are a little too limiting for anything. But
Blasphemy.
That's just personal preference on it. But I did find it very interesting that the Surface Go, this is the first time I've ever actually been able to recommend a Surface Go.
Yeah.
Because typically I would think, well, if it's going to be your only laptop, it's going to be a little low powered. But if this is your supplemental laptop that you carry around school with you, and you need it to sync up over OneDrive to your laptop at home, it seems like it's actually a pretty good deal. In fact, they were asking me about the 64 versus 128 gig size.
Right.
I said, well, you know, if you put things in OneDrive, you can do selective sync. So if that directory gets too big, just unsync it. It's still in the cloud, but you've got more space. So this brought up, so I kind of had two ideas here. The one that the Surface Go could actually be useful in these sorts of niches, especially if people are being told don't use an iPad. And also, you got to make sure you're sending your kids to school with a bag and the stuff in it that won't break their back.
No, this is a serious problem. I've seen a lot of things that clearly oversized and overweighted for kids.
Well, and it hit me that, you know, my first response and her mother's first response was take out some of those books. You know, when we think of a heavy backpack, we think it's because back, you know, when we were in high school, if you had a bunch of books, you know, you could decide to either have a bunch of books in your bag or not make trips to your locker, or you could leave things in your locker and make multiple trips during the day to get them out. And so our mindset is, wow, if you've got a heavy backpack, it must be because you've got a ton of textbooks in there. And it was kind of shocking to hear, no, there's just a three-ring binder and a laptop that's making this thing as heavy as it is.
Now, it wasn't the paper in the three-ring binder that was weighing it down, was it?
I don't think so. I don't think it was, you know, heavyweight paper of, you know, notebook paper typically isn't too bad.
Yeah. So clearly the main problem is that the notebook itself was simply oversized for the young lady.
Yeah, and I get parents' dilemma with this because you want something that your kids can use at home that has enough, you know, stability, especially also with kids. You don't want something that's easily breakable, so you go with something that might be a little bit more chunky, but it's also not a portable at that point. You've taken something that fundamentally was designed to be portable, and really it's not going to serve that purpose that well.
Well, you know, when I sent my daughter off to college, I sent her off with a MacBook Air as a compromise of size and power, and she was fine with it for all 4 years. In fact, I'm using it right now since I inherited it after she graduated from college and gave her a new one. She never complained about the size, and she's not a large person by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, I think the MacBook Air is a good size. This is a 13-inch MacBook Air, by the way, not the 10 or 11, whatever it is. I wonder about the Surface Go, though. You know, the battery life on it might be a challenge for a young person in school that may not have an outlet to reach to.
That's the other thing I wonder about with schools today, and this is further, I think my theme of this entire tech discussion is school isn't what it used to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how available power outlets are in a school today.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's more because there is more technology and, you know, you've got rooms that were computer labs that are now back to regular classrooms because every student has technology already, or what it is. So I would encourage parents, if you aren't sure what sorts of challenges your kid's going to have, go up to the school and, you know, see if you can have someone walk you around just so that you can get an idea about, are there outlets? Should I be getting an external battery that could power some of these things if there's no outlet? The other thing,
go ahead.
This kind of leads into my next point, Another observation, we often think of our kids' school desks as sort of being their office desk, because we have an office desk or we have a desk somewhere at our work. But we forget that at our work and an adult's workplace, they typically have certain creature comforts, like a computer that's always there, a phone, plenty of space, that a student really doesn't. They might have a desk that they work out most of the time, but they're actually much more telecommuters, if you think about it, bouncing in and out of different classrooms, and especially in high school, middle school, high school. And if you've, as a parent, never worked out of your bag before, if you've always had the ability to just, your bag only takes things back and forth from work to home, it's an interesting challenge that you might not have done for a very long time. I think it wasn't until I went to college that I really started thinking about how can I carry less but have it be able to do more, you know? And I think about even simple things like in a three-ring binder having a ruler that also doubles as a hole punch, you know, things like that where you're going, if I was at home right now, if I was at my office, I'd have an actual full-size hole punch, but I'm not going to carry that around with me. And so I would encourage parents to think about those sorts of things, because if you've never worked out of a bag, that's what your kids are going to likely be doing in middle school and high school.
Yeah, and I think for us, we've both spent much of our adult lives working out of a bag with electronics, so it's something we've had to deal with over the years with, you know.
Yeah.
And back when we had terrible batteries and all that kind of stuff. But I think the major thing is, one of the things you hit upon earlier in our discussion is that there is a very different situation for kids in high school versus kids in college. You know, in high school, you have a more regimented classroom schedule. You're changing classes, but you really don't have a lot of control. You know, you've got maybe 10 minutes between every class or whatever, 10, 15 minutes. And you may or may not have an outlet depending which class you're in. In college, you tend to have larger breaks between classes. So you can run to the library or run back to your dorm or something like that. Oh, let me ask my daughter something real quick. When you were in high school, did you guys have outlets in your classrooms for your iPads and your notebooks and things?
I think so.
Yeah, so you never had any problems with power
there. For us, or just that they were there?
They were there that you could use while you're, you know, in between class or during class or whatever.
Maybe, kind of. Not like a ton, because my school, the building is old.
So. Yeah, good point. So old buildings. In fact, if you watch Y5O, you see her school in it, doubling as a Russian embassy. But
hopefully in real life it is not also a Russian embassy.
No, it is not, as far as I know.
A very interesting school experience.
But anyway, yeah, yes. Yeah. So, you know, but it wasn't a huge problem, I don't think.
Even if you know what your kid's school was, if you went to it, it might be different today, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think about schools, you know, every so often they do miraculously get renovated. Yep. And outlets tend to get put in at that point. But then you talk about time between classes in high school. I still remember between classes in high school, we had a high school that was at capacity, could hold 2,500 students. And we got 4 minutes to change classes.
Holy mollies.
So the amount of time that you have, you know, there were days where if you didn't have any time, you realized, okay, to get from point A to point B, it takes me exactly 3 minutes and 55 seconds.
Right.
There's no stopping at the bathroom. There's no stopping at my locker. There's no saying goodbye to someone in the previous class.
You're out of there.
Out the door and move on. So.
Yeah.
Again, a difference in generations, probably.
Right. And by the way, my daughter's school, they actually handed out iPads to every student. So there was that no iPad rule for obvious reasons.
Oh, and that's the interesting thing about teaching and using technology. And I've written down here a little bit, getting at the idea if you're a teacher or an instructor of some kind, what your thoughts on technology should be. The next couple of items I had, the first was thinking about digital analogs, what we replace things with. And this year I am, for my third fall, a coordinator of a large program for our incoming freshmen, our first year seminar program. And my instructors get a one-note instructor manual that if I were to print it out and put it in a three-ring binder for them, would probably be about 200 pages each. That would have been what you would have done 10, 15 years ago. Now it's all online. And I think that's a good change. And I think for teachers and students alike, that's a good change. But you do lose things. And I think sometimes you forget about it. So, for example, ebooks are virtually impossible to browse.
Yes.
Like you can't just sit there and just flip through some pages and see what's in there, and preview things. Same thing with video content. I've heard people complain about, it used to be that if you were interested in a subject or a trade, you could grab a book, an entry-level how-to, and flip through and scan until you found the section that was of interest.
Yeah.
Today, if you tell someone, oh, just go watch this video, that's an hour-long video, they can't scan through and just go, oh, you know, this moment, I think his mouth is making out the words, whatever, and I can stop here and listen for a little bit, unless there's chapters in that video.
Yeah.
And so you gain the idea of lightweight, no book. You lose scanning and previewing, which is something that may be useful in that particular educational
situation. Yeah, I agree completely. And if not useful, it's convenient and fast. Mm-hmm. You just skim through a paper book. I have a question about OneNote, though. So OneNote in Windows is going to go away, the traditional, you know, non-modern UI OneNote. And it's going to go to what I consider to be the much weaker Windows App Store. I forget what they call it. I guess the modern UI version. So are you going to have are you anticipating any issues when Microsoft forces you to make that move?
I'm not, because most of what I'm doing in OneNote is really very basic.
Okay.
But I've already sort of thought about if they were to take away a lot more. So for example, right now I use sections and I use section groups so that you can actually put a bunch of different sections in one folder. If they were to decide, oh, we're going to do something more flat, such as, you know, Evernote's methods, or it's just going to be all in one place. Basically, the farther they get away from a notebook analog and more to a note-taking analog, you know, just like Apple Notes, the harder it will be for me to format it the way I'd like. I do think at some point, the next logical place, until Microsoft ruins that, would be SharePoint. Because in SharePoint, I could build exactly what I want and then make invite people in to be viewers of it. But that is a good point. Microsoft has this annoying knack of taking technology that's working perfectly for what people want it to do, aka Skype, and changing it to be what they think people should want.
Yeah, in fact...
Paradox of the 80-20. 80% of your users only use 20% of the features, but they all use a different 20%.
Yeah, in fact, speaking of Microsoft's degrading of perfectly usable software like Skype, your audio started getting a little, I guess aliasing is what you're starting to not break up exactly, but I can hear the aliasing in the sound. And so I thought, oh, I'll go to Skype and bring up their tech window and see what kind of issues it's reporting. Well, guess what's missing in a new version of Skype? Thank you, Microsoft, for absolutely nothing.
You didn't want all that technical information. I mean, that was just geek stuff. You wouldn't have ever cared about that, according to Microsoft.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's a good example of that feature that only 20% of your users use, but they want it.
Yeah. They did add emojis, however, so there's that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I don't get is, again, how are things like tech info windows hard to maintain or hard to implement?
Apparently, it's very difficult to maintain. Yeah.
I guess so.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking now. So is it under Help? No. Tools? No. Window? No. Which is where it used to be, I think. View? No. Edit? No. They did put emojis and symbols. File? No. And Skype? No. So, thanks a lot, Microsoft.
No, no. No, no. And more no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Microsoft.
Yeah.
So, moving back to the technology and back to school. Another debate that I think of every year, especially with my students, is the two-app or not-two-app.
Mm.
So, for example, calculators. Everyone has a calculator app on their phone.
Yeah.
But yet, people buy calculators. And I don't think it's because they don't want to use their phone for it. I think in some situations, people realize it's a lot quicker to have a dedicated tool. The calculator doesn't, you know, do anything else, but it's right there. And when I've got papers out and I'm writing things down, having a full keyboard and having actual physical buttons is a faster input than using a screen.
Yeah, true.
Rulers, I think, are a good example. You can get ruler apps and you can lay paper down and trace, but sometimes you just want a full ruler. Books I already mentioned.
Yep.
So be very leery, especially when talking with your kids or talking with your students about just saying, oh, use the app. You know, I think when, for example, when I teach statistics, I still tell my students I want them to buy a dedicated calculator for $20. It's not a huge expensive one, but it has statistical functions in it. And I do that because the app that I use that has the same functions, I don't think is as intuitive as the calculator.
Mm.
And also, it's much harder to get a quick calculation when you have to open your phone, swipe up, put in your PIN, whatever you need to do, find that particular calculator that maybe you don't use that often, load it up. By the time you've done that, I've already punched in whatever, minus whatever, divide by whatever. So it's an interesting analog digital sort of convergence.
But. Yeah, it is. It is. And in fact, when my daughter was in college, I know we had the discussion about, I think her stats prof also told her to buy a calculator. And I said, go ahead, of course, but why don't you also buy a an app for your iPhone or iPad?
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of hesitated, but she did. And I found one that was a nice HP clone that I use myself now. I liked it so much. I bought one for myself.
The one that I use, if anyone ever cares, is NeoCal.
Mm.
NeoCal, if you get the advanced version of NeoCal, it actually has stats functions. It's one of the new functions on there. So I am a big endorser of that calculator, but still, my TI, I think it's a 36X, which costs the whole $20, still functions a lot better in terms of quickness.
You know, I was just wondering what students in the arts do, since I don't think any of us, well, I don't know, you might, I don't know anybody of you know, say my daughter's age who went through an art program, but I wonder if they do more digital stuff now than traditional media. I kind of hope not. I think you learn more with traditional media, but I don't know.
I think they mix it up a little bit more than we think.
Yeah.
Because I do know that art students that I see still carry around
stuff,
large bags of art supplies.
Yeah.
But the art supplies, when you talk to them, are a good mix of traditional art supplies and digital art supplies. Yeah. Styluses and tablets and Wacom tablets and things like that.
Mm.
So I think they're kind of right on the line there.
Hmm, interesting, because I've been searching for a nice watercolor app for the iPad, and the closest one I have is Taiyasui's Sketches Pro, which does a pretty nice simulation of watercolor painting. But even the really good apps, and I'm not saying Taiyasui's not good, but even the, I should say, other really good apps like Procreate, which is super duper, it has a terrible watercolor brush. At least the one that comes with it. I don't know if there's add-ons you can buy. And I was just watching Stafe of Stafe Draws on YouTube review the Art Studio Pro app, which is another, highly regarded app. And he said he didn't understand how the watercolor thing on that worked either, so I didn't buy it. I was thinking as watching his review, if he likes the watercolor brush and it looks good in the demo, I'm going to go buy this thing. And it's not too expensive. It's like $10-$12 or something, but no, it didn't. So then I went looking for a dedicated watercolor brush app and couldn't find it. Anyway, that led to my question about wonder what art students do. There isn't an app for everything yet, it turns out.
That's true.
It's pretty darn close.
Well, and the other thing that I think about quite a bit, because this research is coming up in the news more and more, is this idea of, is it more effective for students to write on paper versus type out their notes?
Yeah.
And this is work that I know a few of the people that are involved in this work, and I don't feel like the media has done quite the best job of explaining it. Because as a psychologist, what happens is you really get into one of two things. You are either passively working with information and recording it, or you're actively engaged with it.
Okay.
And the problem I see most of the time is that when this whole debate of writing versus typing comes up, it's assumed that both times you're using the same forms of processing, when in reality you typically aren't. Because people can type faster than they write,
yep.
I think what happens very often is when you're in a classroom and the teacher's talking, you just type exactly what they just said.
Hmm.
You know, it's almost like taking dictation.
Mm-hmm.
And as anyone who's ever taken dictation knows, you might not have any idea what you just wrote
or
what you just typed out, because you weren't really concerned about that. You were concerned about just getting it down accurately on paper or on computer as quickly as possible. I've switched my own note-taking between a combination of writing and typing, and it always comes down to if I'm thinking about what I'm actually doing. So if you have a child who says, you know what, I want to use a tablet to take notes and I want to type them out, I would just have a conversation about when you're doing that, make sure you're putting it in your own work, that you're actively listening and then restating it in your own way. Because that's what you would do typically with a notepad, because you wouldn't have enough time to write down everything as quickly as it's being said. Right. I've seen people speed write, too, and you ask them what their notes say, and they don't have any idea.
Yeah. So. But, you know, my problem, and this has been a shifting problem. This wasn't always true. When I was younger, and I've been cleaning out my mom's home for a while, like a year. It's taking forever. But I found some, like, old notebooks littered from high school and stuff. And my handwriting back then was surprisingly good. But now, if you ask me to handwrite notes, I could do it. And I would be paraphrasing, like you said, writing my own words, because, you know, I can't write fast enough. But you know what? I can't read my notes when I go back to them. So it'd be kind of useless.
That's interesting. I can still read my notes pretty well, even if I'm scribbling them down. So yeah. I guess that's a good thing. I'll have to keep an eye out for that. I want to make sure I never get to the point where I can't read my own writing.
And, you know, you're quite a bit younger than me. So let me tell you, when I was your age, my handwriting was still pretty decent. But I don't know if it's laziness or some kind of a cognitive deficit that occurs over the years, or some kind of motor impairment that happens over the years. But my handwriting has gotten progressively worse. And by that, I mean, you know, actual note-taking. So... I don't think I can read my notes anymore. In fact, I know I can't read my notes anymore if I start scribbling a lot.
I'm going to blame the rabbits. I don't know what they did, but that's, you know, I don't have them and you do, so we'll go with that.
But yeah, it is an interesting question. And of course, there are some people who just don't write quickly or well enough to take adequate notes in class. So, you know, I think it depends on the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which mode is best.
That's a good way to leave it. I would never want to recommend to parents or teachers that they totally stop everyone from typing notes to go to writing, or that they totally get everyone typing notes, because it's going to be different for each person and what's going to be most effective for them.
Right. One more thing. If you're uploading your notes to a cloud, either in a cloud service by default or, you know, saving it automatically OneDrive, even if you lose your device, theoretically, you still have your notes, but anyway.
Yep, that is another good reason to think about electronic notes.
Or scan your paper notes, but...
Yep, that too. And then two quick ideas. The first is a falsehood that I want to remind everyone of, because it's so easy this time of year to get into it. The falsehood of the Generation Z kids know technology.
What? That's false?
Yeah, that is a little bit false. They know certain technologies very well.
Yeah.
Other technologies, I think I shared on the podcast recently that I was showing a few people, one of which is young enough to be considered Gen Z, some things in Excel. And I was saying, you know, you can do conditional formatting. And they just were completely blown away by it. And we forget that when we were growing up and learning technology, for example, in a time before the internet, it might have been considered recreation to fire up Microsoft Excel and play with it.
You couldn't go online.
There weren't any, you know, you can only play so much solitaire,
right?
Versi or something like that. So you fired up, you know, a word processor and you thought, well, gee, what would it look like if I use this feature? Oh, that looks pretty cool. Or
maybe I can do it in a macro.
Yeah, how does this table of contents feature work? Or how does this or that work? We forget that kids today have no incentive to do that. If it's not required of them to use a piece of software, they never, you know, I remember having exciting moments of, oh, wow, I just got the new version of Word or something. I'm going to go play around with that. Nobody does that anymore.
That's true.
But if you think that just because someone grew up with technology, they used it the same way you did when you first got access to technology, I mean, just watch your three-year-olds. Are they playing with Microsoft Word and, you know, Excel, or are they on YouTube? They're on YouTube. So just remember that, yes, the Generation Z and the upper millennials, they do know technology, but they don't know necessarily the productive uses of technology. They know more of the recreational uses of technology and the communication uses of technology.
Right. They might be broad, but not deep.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Yeah.
They never had that, 3 months of playing around with the newest Office package just because you didn't have the internet and you didn't even, if you had internet, you didn't have anything on it that you wanted to go view.
So. Oh, it's too slow.
Yeah, that too. I was on bash.org the other day.
Okay.
Bash.org, for those that don't know, is a collection of IRC quotes. People copy and paste in humorous snippets of IRC. And some of the things on there are pretty funny.
Oh, I was going to guess it was where you learned to do scripting in Bash, but I guess not.
No. Bash.org. But the thing that reminds me about Bash.org is that Bash.org hasn't changed in UI appearance in 25 years.
Okay.
It's exactly the same. I don't even know if it's still actively added to or updated, but it's kind of a fun little snippet of internet history. But I remember Bash.org because back in a time when internet was very slow and spotty, so I'd be traveling somewhere and I'd have a GPRS internet connection.
Oh, golly.
I could go on Bash.org and I could open the random feature in a bunch of different tabs and then disconnect from the internet and have a lot of reading for like the next half hour to an hour of just funny, commentaries and things like that on just jokes, basically. So that was what was enjoyable in 1999, 2000. It was not what we would think of as what kids are doing today.
Well, to go back even further, I think I've told this story before, but in context, I think it's worth retelling. So many years ago, I had a TRS-80 Model 1, for those who may remember that from, a.k.a. the Trash 80 from Radio Shack. Mm-hmm. And it was a fine, very inexpensive computer. You could get a completely functional system for, I think, about $600, including a display. No disk drive, so at that price, you use cassette tape. But in any case, I bought a Hayes Smart Modem 300, for those of you who remember what an analog modem is. And 300 means 300 bits per second.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how to explain it to somebody who gets hundreds of megabits a second these days, but it's not fast. But in any case, I got a smart modem, I had a Trash 80, and I had one problem. There was no software to use it. So, I sat there looking at the modem, and I said, oh, I have a Z80 assembler. And so I wrote a little terminal emulation program. I think I emulated like a VT52 or something like that. And I said, oh, this is not bad. I think I might have published it in one of the little Trash 80 magazines. But at any rate, so, you're right. I wanted to get online. That's why I bought a modem, but I had no way to get online, even though I had the hardware. So back in those days, you wrote it yourself. In fact, I remember thinking one day I was reading about this company called, this little tiny company was starting up called Microsoft. And how they were selling, various and sundry things. And I said, why would you do that? Why didn't you just write it yourself? I don't understand this. But in any case, they did real well from themselves, I hear. Interesting, I'm looking at bash.org now. Actually, it looks pretty good. It does say copyright 1999 to 2018. So apparently somebody's at least updating the copyright notice.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fun thing to go through and just...
Yeah.
Since a lot of these are from the late 90s of IRC chat, some fun reminders of the way the world was.
It does say new content rolling in with moderators and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So bash.org, folks, it has nothing to do with the bash shell in Linux, which is what I thought John was going to go to.
I am sorry that I burst your bubble on that.
Yeah. Okay, so the other thing.
Last thing is just thinking about, I've been thinking about my Apple Watch a lot lately because, after I had to have it repaired and I've just been thinking about how I use it regularly.
Right.
And I thought about, is it a good or a bad thing in the classroom? Mm. I definitely have a lot of students today that have Apple Watches. Mm. I see a lot of people just with Apple Watches. And I don't really know. I don't really see my students using their Apple Watch that often in class, even to check the time, which is sort of bizarre. I've seen students pull out a phone to look at what time it is when their watch is right on their wrist. But it's one of those things I think the jury is still out on. I do definitely think Apple Watches have the capacity to totally change physical education programs.
Oh, yeah.
Especially now with the ability to challenge others to a physical, you know, challenge coming up in Watch OS 5. And with certain schools using Apple Watches for their student IDs, if you're a school that can afford to Apple out your students, a.k.a. give them an iPhone, an Apple Watch, and an iPad.
Wow, that's a lot, but okay.
There are schools, I'm sure, that charge enough tuition for it. But if you think about it, that could be your way to also run your physical education courses. I think, you know, the days of we're all going to get together and we're all going to go for a jog at the same time, that might not be as useful as an instructor in an online phys ed course, which sounds counterintuitive, saying, okay, this week we're all going to work on this, and so your challenge this week is to submit a, you know, activity report from your Apple Watch that shows you ran this many miles or you did this much activity. And I think that could actually create, you know, some of the things that people hated about physical education courses was the self-consciousness around other people. I'm not doing as well as they are. Locker rooms, all that stuff. It could actually be a pretty cool idea that you just have your Apple Watch. It reports back in what you're doing. And you earn your credit for the physical education course by doing these things on your own time or with your own friends or something like that.
And, you know, having gone to a small rural school at one point in my life, for folks who simply don't have a lot of kids in their school, it might be an interesting way to do not a team sport, but a group sport where, you know, you have a significant number of people providing some competitive kind of challenge to you.
I could even see this is now something where you could quantify that you've never been able to quantify before. So when you're playing a team sport, like volleyball or something where you've got everyone working kind of in tandem on a team and your coach is yelling at you to hustle, you've never been able to quantify hustle before, but now you actually could. You could combine all of their Apple Watch readings and you could say, you know, in terms of physical calories burned, you guys were a lot higher as a team today than you were, you know, last week and things like that.
That would be interesting. that would be funny. I like it.
So that's sort of my whole thing on back to school tech. I think where I think you just need to be intelligent about it. You need to take it case by case. You definitely need to put yourself in your kids' shoes and not what you think your kids are experiencing. Like actually pick up their backpacks and see how heavy the things are.
Yeah.
And just be flexible because in education we are still trying to figure out what all of this means and what all of it will interact with for the future.
Yeah, and you know, and don't forget to count for individual differences because, you know, one of the things that still shocks me to this day is when I sent my daughter off to college 5 years ago, I sent her with a MacBook Air, like I said, the one I'm using right now, an iPad 3, you know, which was just called the new iPad back then.
Yes.
And a phone, and an iPhone. And the iPhone and the MacBook got the most usage. She hardly used her iPad. And I, to this day, I don't understand why. And when she went off to grad school, I bought her a new MacBook Air, new iPhone, and an iPad mini, because I figured, well, maybe it's smaller and easier to carry. And still doesn't use the iPad. I don't know. So, I don't get it. I love my iPad mini, even though Apple doesn't, apparently.
It definitely depends on how you use the technology. You know, my daily life around work is a Surface tablet and an iPad, and I'm even thinking about, do I need the Surface tablet to go back and forth? I might take one of my old MacBooks up to one of my offices and just leave the MacBook set up there all the time.
Yeah.
And then leave the Surface tablet in the other office. Because 3 years ago, the technology I needed a Surface tablet both places. Today, the technology I need, I don't need the Surface tablet in both places. I just need a computer in both places.
Okay. And on that note, I'll leave with one final thought. I think a week or two ago, I mentioned that I bought the Amazon Fire. What the heck is it called? Anyway, their Fire HD 8 tablet, right? Because it was on sale for $50.
Yes, I openly questioned this decision of yours, but
but anyway, so there's something weird happening on it because yesterday I noticed that it had downloaded a game, and I had not asked it to download a game. And you can say, well, Todd, you might have accidentally pressed one of the ads. And I would tell you, yeah, you could be right. I don't think so, but you could be right. I'll give that to you. This morning, I woke up and I heard it beep, right? I walked near past it. I heard it beep. So why is it beeping? It's not. I don't really have it set up with a calendar or anything, right? So it shouldn't be alarming me for anything. So I tapped it, and and looked at the screen and says, I've downloaded 5 movies. What? Why did you? Which movies did you download? First of all, I think one of them was a Star Trek Beyond or something. But I got to go look at it again. I just noticed it before we started the podcast. So I set it to airplane mode because I didn't want it downloading anything else.
It's a great way to blow through an internet data cap.
I don't have an internet data cap, but yeah, I mean, it was just disturbing. Why are you downloading things when and okay, like I said, I will give you the possibility that I tap download this game, whatever it was, like a bubble burst game or something, by accident when I was using it yesterday. But I had not touched it since yesterday. It was just charging on a stand, right? And I beeped and I looked down and said, "Yeah, downloaded 5 movies." I'm kind of curious what the other 4 movies are now. But anyway. Okay, that brings to an end Mobius Podcast 254, and we will talk to you next time.